From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, is the current prison justice system creating more harsh criminals and a more dangerous America? Can we rethink crime and punishment? This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. On Tuesday, February 19th, 200 survivors of violent crimes from across Texas will come together for the first time on the steps of the Texas State Capitol. Survivors Speak is partnering with Crime Survivors for Safety and Justice, and they will be calling for a public safety agenda that they say will make Texas safer. But they are not calling for tougher police tactics, longer prison sentences, and harsher treatment of lawbreakers. They say society is locked into a cycle of crime that provides few avenues for healing and treatment for both the victims and the perpetrators. They are calling for improvements to the Texas Victims Compensation System, which provides services to crime survivors, and they want to see improvements to the Texas probation system to reduce recidivism, improve public safety, and improve outcomes with taxpayer dollars. Mariah Lucas is a survivor of violent crime and an advocate for Survivors Speak.
My mother was murdered when I was a baby. Her death caused a downward spiral for pretty much every member of my family, resulting in my dad's criminal catapult into the prison system. He spent much of my childhood behind bars. After my mother's death, we spent the next 6.5 years in below-level poverty. My dad battled drug and alcohol addiction, which ultimately led to him engaging in violent crime himself, leaving me and my older brother to live with a family member. That family member continued our abuse and our victimization because he didn't have the proper resources to counsel us and ensure that we had the tools and the equipment that we needed to recover from the trauma that we had already experienced. And then to top it all off, when I was a teenager, I was actually raped for a period of years by my family member who I lived with. And that kind of pushed me into my own ideation of being involved in violent relationships. I ended up having a child with a very abusive man, entered into a domestic violence relationship, and was just so uneducated and misinformed about what victimization really was from such a young age that I allowed it to come into my life because I thought it was the normal thing to do. So now as a woman who's very educated on victimization and has dealt with victimization and overcoming that trauma, I seek to advocate for other victims and to advocate for members of the community who are impacted by incarceration, so that together we can heal and we can build a better future.
Frequently, when victims of crime are involved in these types of conversations, they bring a voice of harsher penalties, tougher crime stance, but your voice is different than that.
Yes. Far too often victims are just not cared for enough, and that's a lot of the reason that kind of societal image that we have as victims, you know, wanting harsher punishments and wanting longer periods of incarceration, that's where that stems from. It's just because victims aren't being cared for properly. But myself, in my own victimization and the opportunity that I had to heal, I was actually an instrumental part in getting the man who killed my mother out of prison in 2016. I advocated for him and worked with the governor of California to actually get him released from prison. So knowing about the tools and about the system that we can create, it made me want to be involved in it so much more, because I knew that if enough people got involved, we could change the narrative and ensure that if we are building and building upon a foundation of criminal justice and incarceration that actually advocates and puts into the community rehabilitated individuals instead of sending out criminals and offenders that have no remorse or no accountability for what they've done, all we are doing is opening the door for more victimization. So I want to be one of those victims that advocates for change and advocates for accountability and responsibility, but also advocates for the needs of the offenders and the offenders' families so that they have the tools and the mechanisms and the programs in place to overcome what they did. They shouldn't always be categorized as their worst mistake.
So do you see the criminal justice system that we have now as actually creating more crime?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that there are plenty of people working hard to counter that. But right now, with this Tough on Crime initiative, all we are doing is hurting the community. When we refuse to understand and analyze the issues that are underlying when it comes to criminal behavior, we can't expect this criminal behavior to change.
You know, you're a victim of crime. You've seen it. You've seen how horrible people can be. You just don't think that we're dealing with it in a way that is positive. Help me understand.
So I'm going to give you a little insight into my personal story and my personal experience with this. The man who killed my mother as a teenager, he had already had some encounters with the criminal justice system. He had already been caught a couple times for drugs and alcohol addiction, for prostitution, for some minor violent issues. And had he been given the opportunity to rehabilitate himself and to overcome those issues and those trials that he was facing in his life, I firmly believe that he would have never been in the position that he was to commit such a violent crime against my mother. Now, with that being said, this man did take accountability for what he had done to my mother. He did turn himself in and he did spend, you know, his court trial saying, yes, it was me, I did this. He spent 24 years, 5 months behind prison bars. And in those 24 years, 5 months, he got to see all kinds of people. He got to see people who had no desire to change, no desire to recover. And then he came across people who actually had a desire to change themselves and to be better. And so he enrolled himself into these programs, these evidence-based practices that really work, that make a difference in these offenders' lives. And he overcame all of that in the face of adversity. He overcame all those traumas, all of those bad, negative criminal actions and behaviors that he had had before. And he realized that if he put as much energy into overcoming these issues and put as much energy into learning and educating himself on how to be a decent law-abiding citizen, he can make all of the difference. And so he did. And because of that, he has spent the last 2 years outside of prison helping people in his community to make sure that they don't fall in the same path that he did. So I know that people can change. I 100% believe it. If they're offered the right tools and the right programs and are, you know, we're implementing these evidence-based practices and incentivizing people to actually succeed, I have no doubt in my mind that we can change the justice system.
So what are some first steps?
Well, CSSJ is working hard on implementing some new bills and taking some new bills to the Capitol in Texas. We are wanting to focus our efforts on making improvements to the probation system. Right now in the state of Texas, the offenders that are placed on probation aren't incentivized enough to actually contribute to the community. You know, they have a difficult time getting jobs. They're not given resources to actually succeed. So they reoffend because it's just easier for them to go back to jail. So we want to make sure that the probation system is acknowledging the efforts and the work that these individuals are doing And by successfully implementing these new practices and acquiring new legislation that would also, you know, give us the proper utilization of the funds and attention to the probation departments, we can actually reduce the amount of victimization and criminalization that is happening in our communities. We could stop shuffling around these inmates from jail to the community to probation centers and back to jail. And we can make a difference not only in their lives, but in the lives of the victims that are actually being impacted by these violent behaviors.
Mariah Lucas is a survivor of violent crime and is an advocate for the group Survivors Speak, which is calling for policies that focus on preventing crime, supporting crime victims, reducing incarceration, and improvements to rehabilitation. They are holding a rally on the Texas State Capitol on Tuesday. When Reginald Dwayne Betts was 16, he took a gun and committed a crime. He carjacked someone. 24 hours later, he was arrested. Later, tried as an adult, he was sent to prison, where he did 8 years. Today, Betts is an acclaimed poet and writer. He earned a law degree from Yale and is an attorney. I asked him to start off our conversation with one of his poems.
Triptych. But for it's always game. A man can be murdered twice, but for science. His body a pool of blood in Baltimore and Tulsa, except it isn't. His body actually slender against the sunlight just outside a California prison. A crow rests on the fence near his car. Visiting hours long done. For man, not crow, one of a murderous many that flies above this barbed wire. And the cigarette he smokes is illegal here. And but for the magnetic pull tragedy has on black women, he wouldn't be here right now, contemplating the crimson-colored man leaping into the darkness on his Nikes. He still says they're Jordans because air is important. Adjectives swearing to black America's aim, if not ability, to soar. A way to outrun statistics and the lead in the water. Alas, metaphysics says you are only you and no one else. And a black poet says black love is not one or 1,000 things. And it all may be true. But for the fact that the man swears the crow looks at him dead as if he is so already. As if while standing there, he has been murdered by his brother, murdered by a cop, embodied by a prison sentence, as flames from Newport's burning ash fail to illuminate his shadow.
What is poetry for you?
It's a lot of things, actually. And maybe it's everything, but it's definitely my primary means of communication and understanding the world. And I think it's a way for me to get closer to whatever it is that I believe is true. And what I'm lucky to communicate that truth to somebody else.
You have had some traumatic experiences. You found yourself incarcerated at a very young age. And that has led you to where we are today. And that is struggles, setbacks, and victories. Is all that evident in your poetry?
Yeah, but I might flip that. And I might say that I have caused others to experience very traumatic things. And as a consequence of that, and as a consequence of our country's really inability to deal with it when somebody commits a crime and causes real harm to somebody else, to sort of understand it and approach it in a way that isn't intended to just cause the person who caused harm or suffering. I was put in a situation that I don't think even the people in charge of those decisions would have considered just if they were just talking over dinner. And yeah, those things have led me to experience things that I regret, that I wish I didn't remember. But I think they've also compelled me to have a kind of compassion and kind of awareness about the world that I otherwise wouldn't have had. So, you know, you take the good with the bad. And all things considered, most people who do something as horribly wrong as carjacking somebody don't get to become lawyers and publish poets and get invited to speak at different universities. So I don't think I could complain too much.
Still, you were 16 years old, just a little more than a month after your 16th birthday, when you did that carjacking, and you were not brought into the juvenile justice system. You were tried as an adult. Is that fair?
No. But is it fair? No, it's not fair, but is it justice? I don't think it's justice. I mean, part of it is that you don't want to put somebody in a position where they aren't physically equipped to, like, survive. And a lot of kids who get placed in an adult system just aren't physically equipped to survive. And then even if they're physically equipped, a lot of times they aren't mentally or emotionally equipped. And so that's one reason why it's not fair. And another reason why it's not fair is that, you know, we think that we reserve that kind of punishment for whoever we would consider the worst of the worst. But the reality is that most of the folks tried as adults and sent to prison when adults come home. The average prison sentence is about 3 years. And that's not, and it's not much different for juveniles who get tried as adults. I did 9 years, which meant that I was coming home, you know. I was coming home at 24 years old. And so the question might have been, what is the most appropriate punishment that will not lead him to suffer in a way while incarcerated, that will lead him to cause more suffering when he's released? And I think that's just like a really complicated question that we don't ask our criminal justice system to answer. And we don't ask it to answer. We don't ask the system to answer that question for the most vulnerable people who get placed into the system. But we also don't really ask the system to answer that question for anybody. And so as a result, the outcomes of incarceration are completely unpredictable right now. And we talk about measures like recidivism without admitting that we haven't thought seriously about how to craft a system that's worthy of being sort of evaluated based on metrics like recidivism.
Well, we really don't have a defined objective when it comes to what we want from people who are released from prison. We just, the idea is just to put people in prison as a punishment and to take away years from their life and to separate them from their family and community. And there's not a whole lot of consideration about what to do when they're released.
Right. No, that's true. And I, you know, in some of my poems, I do think this book in particular, Felon, I think, you know, Felon, another spelling of my name. I think one of the things I try to do is to reveal some of that reality through the poems, that you come home and people have so little expectations for you. And sometimes they put impediments in your way that frustrate the expectations that you have for yourself.
But you were in prison and you were released and then gradually you were able to work your way into a position where you were able to get an education, become a teacher, actually go to law school, and now you are a working lawyer.
Yeah.
And why are you able to do that?
I don't know. I mean, I think anytime somebody tries to answer a question like that, they risk falling into the trap of kind of describing the way in which they're exceptional. I will say I have been able to do that because through everything, I wasn't traumatized to such a degree that it incapacitated me. And I've been able to do those things because I went into prison in some ways equipped to educate myself. I was already a reader. I was already a pretty good student. And so I went into a system prepared to find ways to become better. And I found poetry, and the poetry gave me something to become more engaged with. But also, I just, you know, that's one of those questions that you can never ask, because there's people who I know who are just as intelligent as I am, who are just as thoughtful, who are just as ambitious and haven't had the kind of outcome. And sometimes that's just because they have suffered in ways that I haven't. And sometimes it's just because they did something that it was even more difficult for them to overcome than what I did. And I don't mean like overcome based on what society says or what society puts in your way, but just internally, how do you grapple with the harm that you cause people? You know, I know folks that cause the kind of harm that they live with, and it precludes them from ever really getting over. But I wish I had an answer to that question, because if I had an answer to that question, then I would have something to say when people say, what should the system look like? But I'm just not sure if I could point to any one or 100 of my experiences that helped me do this thing. It's sort of the accumulation of things. And, you know, if one thing was different, everything might be different.
Has poetry played a role in you processing the trauma that you've experienced and the trauma that you inflicted on others, trying to come up with a framework that keeps you from slipping back into self-destructive behavior?
Nah, you know, I try to be honest about poetry not being therapy. And it has been no real risk. I mean, maybe we all slip into self-destructive behavior at some point, but the kind of self-destructive behavior that we engage in as adults might just be something like procrastination. You know, it might just be like not being thoughtful to the people that we love. It might be drinking a little bit too much. So I think it's all kinds of ways that we are self-destructive that isn't criminal. And I think if the question is like, has poetry helped me from not engaging in criminal behavior? You know, honestly, I just have no desire to commit crimes. I mean, I think I kind of love people, love humanity, and I don't really want to harm somebody in a way that I just, for whatever reason, seem to be capable of doing when I was 16. And in terms of helping me deal with trauma or deal with the world, I think, you know, poetry helps me understand the world, but and maybe poetry helps me be aware of trauma in ways that I might not be if I wasn't a poet, if I didn't write these things and think about these things so much. But I'm not sure if poetry has ever helped me deal with anything. You know, I think, I don't know, what it takes to deal with something is probably something that I wouldn't want to put on a poem. And I've had students, you know, who have written about some really hard things and some really dark things, and I wouldn't dare say that poetry helped them deal with it. I would just say that maybe poetry helped them articulate it, but they still figuring out how to deal with it in the same way probably that I'm definitely still figuring out how to deal with my stuff. I think what poetry has given me an opportunity and access to is a voice, is a way to say some of these things and to talk about some of these things. I think that's what poetry has done, and I think generally that's what poetry does.
Poetry came to you when you were in solitary confinement. Why were you in solitary?
Yeah. Oh, man, it's such a long story.
Was it for your own protection?
No. They didn't do anything for my protection. I had an assault and an officer charge, but you know, to describe it that way is just like 100% false. You know, basically, I wouldn't let a guard close me into my cell, and they said I hit him with a door, but I didn't hit him with a door. And so I didn't hit them with my cell door. I just stopped her from closing me in. And they sent me to the hold for assault on an officer. And it was really just incidental contact because, you know, the person didn't get hurt. The door actually didn't hit the person at all. I just, like, blocked them from closing my door. But I got 6 months in the hold for that. And, I did 6 months of solitary for it. And while I was there, somebody gave me a book, The Black Poets, to read. It's actually a profile on Dudley Randall, the editor of that, in the New York Times Magazine today. But, you know, Detroit guy, great book, collected poems from, you know, late 1800s up to about the 1960s. And it just exposed me to a world that I didn't know existed. And it's something about being aware of something that kind of changes how you live in the world. And I became aware of that, and it changed how I live in the world in the same way that, you know, becoming aware of prison changed how I live in the world.
That was a demonstration of power by that guard and the system, being able to say, even though the events, as you relay them, they could just say, no, this is what happened, and there's no way for you to appeal. This is what's going to happen to you. And a lot of people live in that world all the time, and it's a beat down. And how do you come back from that? Right. How do you come back from that?
I don't know.
You did it.
Yeah, no, but I was telling somebody today, man, I've lived more moments of desperation than I care to admit. And I think a lot of times, you know, when we say people come back from something, it's not that it suggests that they didn't live these moments of desperation, but I don't know. I just had a lot of these moments of desperation. And I figured some things out, but it's been a struggle. So I'm not sure the how. I mean, I think part of it for me has always been education, though. You know, I think academic institutions have been welcoming in ways that the society hasn't. And it gave me a footing. And then I was young enough that I could prove myself in academic institutions.
You now are working, in addition to your literary work and as an attorney, also as you work towards juvenile justice reform. What do you want to see? What are the main points for juvenile justice reform that you want people to be aware of?
Well, I wouldn't really say I work towards juvenile justice reform right now just because I have a job that really doesn't permit me to do any kind of active advocacy work. But I think that all of my writing in some way advocates for or suggests that we should have criminal justice reform more broadly and juvenile justice reform specifically. But what do I think should happen? I think honestly it's basically not one juvenile justice system. It's probably 1,000. And I think we should reduce incarceration of young people. And I think we should find a way to really invest in sort of developing young people and invest in programming for young folks. And I honestly think it's low-hanging fruit. I mean, there's so many people who get a better education when they get incarcerated than without. And so, I think we should invest in education. And I think if we invested in sort of more broadly in the school systems and some of these places where you find the most incarceration, that it would deal with some of the incarceration at hand. I think if we invest in like family counseling and things like that, it would deal with some of this stuff. But the primary thing I would just say, because what happens is when you ask somebody like me a policy question, I really do need to like step back and say, well, if you ask me what we should do in New Haven, which is a specific place and with a specific set of problems, then my answer is going to be different than if you ask me more generally what we should do. So my sort of more general answer about what we should do is start to rely less on incarceration, because incarceration by its nature for young people leads to more incarceration. So that should be like the absolute last resort. And we spent a lot of time operating criminal justice systems across the country where incarceration was the very first resort. And even for somebody like me who admittedly committed a violent crime, I just don't believe incarceration should have been the first choice. I mean, we had a menu of things that could happen. And when I committed my crime, the only thing on that menu was incarceration. Like, nobody even asked themselves what might happen if we don't lock this kid up. And so I would say very first order, what we should do is expand the menu of options that's available and make incarceration like the last option and make people have to defend their decision to incarcerate a child as opposed to just doing it and everybody publicly accepts it as this is what has to happen.
Reginald Dwayne Betts is a poet and memoirist. He was arrested at 16 for carjacking. He spent 8 years in prison. He is the national spokesman for the Campaign for Youth Justice, and he is the Spring 2019 Social Justice Reading Series author at Our Lady of the Lake University. His reading will be at Our Lady of the Lake on Monday, February 18th at 7 p.m. at Theory Auditorium. The event is open to the public. Betts will share his transformation tale about his life from prison to scholar to poet and Yale Law graduate, and he'll discuss the pressing issues surrounding the U.S. criminal justice system. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org, and that's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to. You could also find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.